They got permission to land. Seen from low orbit and their descent path, the surface of Ganymede didn't look much different than it ever had. Even at its best, the Jovian moon was a wasteland of gray silicate rock and slightly less gray water ice, the entire thing pocked with craters and flash-frozen lakes. It had looked like a battlefield long before humanity's ancestors crawled up onto dry land for the first time. But humans, with their great creativity and industriousness in the domain of destruction, had found ways to make their mark. Holden spotted the almost skeletal remains of a destroyer stretched across the landscape at the end of a long black scar. The shockwave of its impact had flattened smaller domes as far as 10 kilometers away. Tiny rescue ships flitted about its corpse, looking less for survivors than for bits of information or technology that had survived the crash and couldn't be allowed to fall into enemy hands. The worst damage visible was the complete loss of one of the enormous greenhouse domes. The agricultural domes were gigantic structures of steel and glass, with hectares of carefully cultivated soil and meticulously bred and tended crops beneath them. To see one crushed beneath the twisted metal of what looked like a fallen mirror array was shocking and demoralizing. The domes fed the outer planets with their specially bred crops. The most advanced agricultural science in history happened inside them, and the orbiting mirrors were marvels of engineering that helped make it possible. Slamming one into the other and leaving both lying in ruins struck Holden as being as stupidly short-sighted as shitting in your water supply to deny your enemy a drink. By the time the somnambulist had set her creaking bones to rest on their assigned landing pad, Holden had lost all patience with human stupidity. So, of course, it came out to meet him. The customs inspector was waiting for them when they stepped out of the airlock. He was a stick-thin man with a handsome face and an egg-shaped bald head. He was accompanied by two men in nondescript security guard uniforms with tasers and holsters at their belts. "Hello, my name is Mr. Vedas. I'm the customs inspector for Port 11, pads A14 through A22. Your manifest, please." Naomi, once again playing captain, stepped forward and said, "The manifest was transmitted to your office prior to landing. I don't..." Holden saw that Vedas wasn't holding an official cargo inspection terminal, nor were the guards with him wearing Ganymede Port Authority uniforms. He got the tingling premonition of a bad con job about to be played out. He moved up and waved Naomi off. "Captain, I'll take care of this." Customs Inspector Vedas looked him up and down and said, "And you are?" "You can call me Mr. Not Putting Up With Your Bullshit." Vedas scowled, and the two security guards shuffled closer. Holden smiled at them, then reached behind his back and under his coat and pulled out a large pistol. He held it at the side of his leg, pointed at the ground, but they stepped back anyway. Vedas blanched. "I know this shakedown," Holden said. "You ask to look at our manifest, then you tell us which items we have mistakenly included on it. And while we are retransmitting to your office with our newly amended manifest, you and your goons take the plum items and sell them on what I'm guessing is a thriving black market for food and medicine." "I am a legally vested administrator of Ganymede Station," Vedas squeaked. "You think you can bully me with your gun? I'll have port security arrest you and impound your entire ship if you think..." "No, I'm not going to bully you," Holden said. "But I've had it right up to here with idiots profiting from misery, and I'm going to make myself feel better by having my big friend Amos here beat you senseless for trying to steal food and medicine from refugees." "Ain't bullying so much as stress relief," Amos said amiably. Holden nodded at Amos. How angry does it make you that this guy wants to steal from refugees, Amos?
Pretty fucking angry, Captain.
Holden patted his pistol against his thigh. The gun is just to make sure port security there doesn't interfere until Amos has fully worked out his anger issues. Mr. Vedas, customs inspector for Port 11, pads A14 through A22, turned and ran as though his life depended on it, with his rent-a-cops in hot pursuit.
You enjoyed that, Naomi said. Her expression was odd and evaluating, her voice in the no-man's land between accusing and not.
Holden holstered his gun.
Let's go find out what the hell happened here.
Chapter 7. Prax. The security center was on the third layer down from the surface. The finished walls and independent power supply seemed like luxury items compared with the raw ice of other places on the station, but really, they were important signals. The way some plants advertise their poisons by bright foliage, the security center advertised its impregnability. It wasn't enough that it was impossible to tunnel through the ice and sneak a friend or a lover out of the holding cells. Everyone had to know that it was impossible. Know just by looking, or else someone would try it. In all his years on Ganymede, Prax had been there only once before, and then as a witness. As a man there to help the law, not to ask help from it. He'd been back 12 times in the last week, waiting in the long, desperate line, fidgeting and struggling with the almost overpowering sense that he needed to be somewhere else doing something, even if he didn't know what exactly it was.
I'm sorry, Dr. Mung, the woman at the public information counter said from behind her inch-thick, wire-laced window. She looked tired. More than tired. More than exhausted, even. Shell-shocked. Dead.
Nothing today, either. Is there anyone I can talk to? There has to be a way to...
I'm sorry, she said, and her eyes looked past him to the next desperate, frightened, unbathed person that she wouldn't be able to help. Prax walked out, teeth grinding in impotent rage. The line was 2 hours long. Men and women and children stood or leaned or sat. Some were weeping. A young woman with red-rimmed eyes smoked a marijuana cigarette, the smell of burning leaves over the stink of clothes-packed bodies, the smoke curling up past the no-smoking sign on the wall. No one protested. All of them had the haunted look of refugees, even the ones who'd been born here. In the days since the official fighting had stopped, the Martian and Earth militaries had retreated back behind their lines. The breadbasket of the outer planets found itself reduced to a wasteland between them, and the collected intelligence of the station was bent to a single task, getting away. The ports had started out under lockdown by two military forces in conflict, but they'd soon left the surface for the safety of their ships, and the depth of panic and fear in the station could no longer be contained. The few passenger ships that were permitted out were packed with people trying to get anywhere else. The fares for passage were bankrupting people who'd worked for years in some of the highest-paying material science positions outside Earth. The poorer people were left sneaking out in freight drones, or tiny yachts, or even spacesuits strapped onto modified frames and fired off toward Europa in hopes of rescue. Panic drove them from risk to risk until they wound up somewhere else or in the grave. Near the security stations, near the ports, even near the abandoned military cordons set up by Mars and the UN, the corridors were thick with people scrambling for anything they could tell themselves was safety. Prax wished he was with them. Instead, his world had fallen into a kind of rhythm,
He woke at his rooms, because he always went home at night so that he would be there if May came back. He ate whatever he could find. The last 2 days, there hadn't been anything left in his personal storage, but a few of the ornamental plants in the parkways were edible. He wasn't really hungry anyway. Then he checked the body drops. The hospital had maintained a scrolling video feed of the recovered dead to help in identification for the first week. Since then, he'd had to go look at the actual bodies. He was looking for a child, so he didn't have to go through the vast majority of the dead, but the ones he did see haunted him. Twice he'd found a corpse sufficiently mutilated that it might have been May, but the first had a stork bite birthmark at the back of her neck, and the other's toenails were the wrong shape. Those dead girls were someone else's tragedies. Once he'd assured himself that May wasn't among the lists of the dead, he went hunting. The first night she'd been gone, he'd taken out his hand terminal and made a list. People to contact who had official power, security, her doctors, the warring armies. People to contact who might have information, the other parents at her school, the other parents in his medical support group, her mother. Favorite places to check. Her best friend's home, the common space park she liked best, the sweet shop with the lime sherbet she always asked for. Places someone might go to buy a stolen child for sex. A list of bars and brothels off a cached copy of the station directory. The updated directory would be on the system, but it was still locked down. Every day, he crossed as many off the list as he could, and when they were all gone, he started over. From a list, they'd become a schedule. Security every other day, alternating with whoever would talk to him from the Martian forces or the UN on the other days. The parks in the morning, after the body checks. May's best friend and her family had made it out, so there was nothing to check there. The sweet shop had been burned out in a riot. Finding her doctors was the hardest. Dr. Astrigan, her pediatrician, had made all the right concerned noises and promised him that she would call him if she heard anything, and then, when he checked again 3 days later, didn't remember having spoken to him. The surgeon who'd helped drain the abscesses along her spine when she'd first been diagnosed hadn't seen her. Dr. Strickland, from the support and maintenance group, was missing. Nurse Abu Akar was dead. The other families from the group had their own tragedies to work through. May wasn't the only child missing. Katoa Merton, Gabby Solius, Sandro Ventisiete. He'd seen the fear and desperation that shrieked in the back of his head, mirrored in the faces of the other parents. It made those visits harder than looking at bodies. It made the fear hard to forget. He did it anyway. Baja Merton, Katoa Daddy, May called him, was a thick-necked man who always smelled of peppermint. His wife was pencil-thin, with a nervous twitch of a smile. Their home was 6 chambers near the water management complex, 5 levels down from the surface, decorated in spun silk and bamboo. When Baja opened the door, he didn't smile or say hello. He only turned and walked in, leaving the way open. Prax followed him. At the table, Baja poured Prax a glass of miraculously unspoiled milk. It was the 5th time Prax had come since May had gone missing.
No sign then, Baja said.
It wasn't really a question. No news, Prax said. So, there's that at least. From the back of the house, a young girl's voice rose in outrage, matched by a younger boy's.
Baja didn't even turn to look.
Nothing here either. I'm sorry.
The milk tasted wonderful, smooth and rich and soft. Prax could almost feel the calories and nutrients being sucked in through the membranes in his mouth. It occurred to him that he might technically be starving. "There's still hope," Prax said.
Baja blew out his breath like the words had been a punch in the gut.
His lips were pressed thin, and he was staring at the table. The shouting voices in the back resolved into a low, boyish wail.
"We're leaving,"
Baja said.
"My cousin works on Luna for Magellan Biotech. They're sending relief ships, and when they put off the medical supplies, there's going to be room for us. It's all arranged."
Prax put down the glass of milk. The chambers around them seemed to go quiet, but he knew that was an illusion. A strange pressure bloomed in his throat, down into his chest. His face felt waxy. He had the sudden physical memory of his wife announcing that she'd filed for divorce. Betrayed. He felt betrayed.
"After that, another few days,"
Baja was saying. He'd been talking, but Prax hadn't heard him.
"But what about Katoa?"
Prax managed to say around the thickness in his throat.
"He's here somewhere."
Baja's gaze flickered up and then away, fast as a bird's wing.
"He's not. He's gone, brother. Boy had a swamp where his immune system should have been. You know that. Without his medicine, he used to start feeling really sick in 3, maybe 4 days. I have to take care of the 2 kids I still got."
Prax nodded, his body responding without him. He felt like a flywheel had come loose somewhere in the back of his head. The grain of the bamboo table seemed unnaturally sharp. The smell of ice melt. The taste of milk going sour on his tongue.
"You can't know that," he said, trying to keep his voice soft.
He didn't do a great job.
"I pretty much can.
Whoever took May and Katoa, they aren't useful to them dead. They knew. They had to know that they'd need medicine. And so it only makes sense that they'd take them somewhere they could get it."
"No one took them, brother. They got lost. Something happened. May's teacher was scared crazy. Her whole world was making sure toddlers don't spit in each other's mouths too much. And there's a shooting war outside her room. Who the hell knows what she saw? She said May's mother and a doctor. And come on, man. Not useful if they're dead. This station is ass deep in dead people. And I don't see anyone getting useful. It's a war. Fuckers started a war."
There were tears in his wide, dark eyes now, and sorrow in his voice. But there was no fight.
"People die in a war. Kids die. You gotta keep moving." "You don't know," Prax said. "You don't know that they're dead. And until you know, you're abandoning them."
Baja looked down at the floor.
There was a flush rising under the man's skin. He shook his head, the corners of his mouth twitching down.
"You can't go," Prax said. "You have to stay and look for him."
"Don't," Baja said.
"And I mean, do not shout at me in my own home."
"These are our kids. And you don't get to walk away from them."
"What kind of father are you? I mean, Jesus!"
Baja was leaning forward now, hunched over the table.
Behind him, a girl on the edge of womanhood looked in from the hallway, her eyes wide. Prax felt a deep certainty rising in him.
"You're going to stay," he said.
The silence lasted 3 heartbeats. 4. 5.
"It's arranged,"
Baja said.
Prax hit him. He didn't plan it, didn't intend it. His arm rolled through the shoulder, balled fist shooting out of its own accord.
His knuckles sank into the flesh of Baja's cheek, snapping his head to the side and rocking him back.
The big man boiled across the room at him. The first blow hit just below Prax's collarbone, pushing him back. The next one was to his ribs, and the one after that. Prax felt his chair slide out from under him, and he was falling slowly in the low G, but unable to get his feet beneath him. Prax swung wild, kicked out.
He felt his foot connect with something, but he couldn't tell if it was the table or Baja. He hit the floor, and Baja's foot came down on his solar plexus.
The world went bright, shimmering and painful. Somewhere, a long way away, a woman was shouting. He couldn't make out the words, and then, slowly, he could. "He's not right. He lost a baby, too. He's not right." Prax rolled over, forced himself up to his knees. There was blood on his chin, he was pretty sure came from him. No one else there was bleeding.
Baja stood by the table,
hands in fists, nostrils flared, breath fast. The daughter stood in front of him, interposed between her enraged father and Prax. All he could really see of her was her ass and her ponytail and her hands, flat out at her father in the universal gesture for stop. She was saving his life.
"You'd be better off gone, brother,"
Baja said.
"Okay," Prax said. He got to his feet slowly and stumbled to the door, still not quite breathing right. He let himself out. The secret of closed system botanical collapse was this. It's not the thing that breaks you need to watch out for. It's the cascade. The first time he'd lost a whole crop of glycine quinan, it had been from a fungus that didn't hurt soybeans at all. The spores had probably come in with a shipment of ladybugs. The fungus took hold in the hydroponic system, merrily taking up nutrients that weren't meant for it and altering the pH. That weakened the bacteria Prax had been using to fix nitrogen, to the point that they were vulnerable to a phage that wouldn't have been able to take them out otherwise. The nitrogen balance of the system got out of whack. By the time the bacteria recovered to their initial population, the soybeans were yellow, limp, and past repair. That was the metaphor he used when he thought about May and her immune system. The problem was tiny, really. A mutant allele produced a protein that folded left instead of right. A few base pairs difference. But that protein catalyzed a critical step in signal transduction to the T cells. She could have all the parts of an immune system standing ready to fight off a pathogen, but without twice-daily doses of an artificial catalyzing agent, the alarm would never sound. Myers-Skelton premature immunosenescence, they called it. And the preliminary studies still hadn't even been able to tell if it was more common outside the well of Earth because of an unknown low-G effect, or just the high radiation levels increasing mutations rates generally. It didn't matter. However she'd gotten there, May had developed a massive spinal infection when she was 4 months old. If they'd been anywhere else in the outer planets, she'd have died of it. But everyone came to Ganymede to gestate, so the child health research all happened there. When Dr. Strickland saw her, he knew what he was looking at, and he held back the cascade. Prax walked down the corridors toward home. His jaw was swelling. He didn't remember being hit in the jaw, but it was swelling and it hurt. His ribs had a sharp pain on the left that hurt if he breathed in too deep, so he kept his breath shallow. He stopped at one of the parks, scrounging a few leaves for dinner. He paused at a large stand of Epipremnum aureum. The wide, spade-shaped leaves looked wrong. They were still green, but thicker, and with a golden undertone. Someone had put distilled water in the hydroponic supply, instead of the mineral-rich solution long-stability hydroponics needed. They could get away with it for another week, maybe two. Then, the air recycling plants would start to die, and by the time that happened, the cascade would be too far gone to stop. And if they couldn't get the right water to the plants, he couldn't imagine they'd be able to set all the mechanical air recyclers going. Someone was going to have to do something about that. Someone else. In his rooms, his one small glycine kenon held its fronds up to the light. Without any particular conscious thought, he put his finger in the soil, testing it. The rich scent of well-balanced soil was like incense. It was doing pretty well, all things considered. He glanced at the timestamp on his hand terminal. 3 hours had passed since he'd come home. His jaw had gone past aching into a kind of constantly rediscovered pain. Without her medicine, the normal flora of her digestive system would start overgrowing. The bacteria that normally lived benignly in her mouth and throat would rise against her. After 2 weeks, maybe she wouldn't be dead. But even in the best case, she'd be so sick that bringing her back would be problematic. It was a war. Kids died in wars. It was a cascade. He coughed, and the pain was immense, and it was still better than thinking. He needed to go, to get out. Ganymede was dying around him. He wasn't going to do May any good. She was gone. His baby girl was gone. Crying hurt worse than coughing. He didn't sleep so much as lose consciousness. When he woke, his jaw was swollen badly enough that it clicked when he opened his mouth too wide. His ribs felt a degree better. He sat on the edge of his bed, head in his hands. He'd go to the port. He'd go to Baja and apologize, and ask to go along. Get out of the Jovian system entirely, go someplace and start over without his past, without his failed marriage and shattered work, without May. He switched to a slightly less dirty shirt, swabbed his armpits with a damp cloth, combed his hair back. He'd failed. It was pointless. He had to come to terms with the loss and move on, and maybe someday he would. He checked his hand terminal. That day was checking the Martian body drop, walking the parks, checking with Dr. Astrogan, and then a list of 5 brothels he hadn't been to, where he could ask after the illicit pleasures of pedophilia, hopefully without being gutted by some right-thinking, civic-minded thug. Thugs had children, too. Some probably loved them. With a sigh, he keyed in a new entry. Mineralize park water. He'd need to find someone with physical plant access codes. Maybe security could help with that, at least. And maybe, somewhere along the way, he'd find May. There was still hope. Chapter 8. Bobby. The Harmon De Jung was a Doniger-class dreadnought, half a kilometer in length and 250,000 tons dry weight. Her interior docking bay was large enough to hold 4 frigate-class escort ships and a variety of lighter shuttles and repair craft. Currently, it held only 2 ships. The large and almost opulent shuttle that had ferried the Martian ambassadors and state officials up for the flight to Earth, and the smaller and more functional Navy shuttle Bobby had ridden up from Ganymede. Bobby was using the empty space to jog. The De Jung's captain was being pressured by the diplomats to get them to Earth as quickly as possible, so the ship was running at a near-constant 1G acceleration. While this made most of the Martian civilians uncomfortable, it suited Bobby just fine. The Corps trained at high G all the time and did lengthy endurance drills at 1G at least once a month. No one ever said it was to prepare for the possibility of having to fight a ground war on Earth. No one had to. Her recent tour on Ganymede hadn't allowed her to get in any high G exercise, and the long trip to Earth seemed like an excellent opportunity to get back into shape. The last thing she wanted was to appear weak to the natives. "Anything you can do, I can do better," she sang to herself in a breathless falsetto as she ran. "I can do anything better than you." She gave her wristwatch a quick glance. 2 hours. At a current leisurely pace, that meant 12 miles. Push for 20? How many people on Earth regularly ran for 20 miles? Martian propaganda would have her believe that half of the people on Earth didn't even have jobs. They just lived off the government dole and spent their meager allowances on drugs and stim parlors. But probably some of them could run for 20 miles. She'd bet Snoopy and his gang of Earther Marines could have run 20 miles the way they were running from. "Anything you can do, I can do better," she sang, then concentrated on nothing but the sound of her shoes slapping on the metal deck. She didn't see the yeoman enter the docking bay, so when he called out to her, she twisted in surprise and tripped over her own feet, catching herself with her left hand just before she would have dashed her brains out on the deck. She felt something pop in her wrist, and her right knee bounced painfully off the floor as she rolled to absorb the impact. She lay on her back for a few moments, moving her wrist and knee to see if there was any serious damage. Both hurt, but neither had any grating sensation in it. Nothing broken, then. Barely out of the hospital and already looking for ways to bang herself up again. The yeoman ran up to her and dropped into a crouch at her side. "Jesus, Gunny, you took a hell of a spill," the Navy boy said. "A hell of a spill." He touched her right knee, where the bruise was already starting to darken the bare skin below her jogging shorts, then seemed to realize what he was doing and yanked his hand back. "Sergeant Draper, your presence is requested at a meeting in Conference Room G at 1450 hours, he said, squeaking a little as he rattled off his message. "How come you don't carry your terminal with you? They've had trouble tracking you down." Bobby pushed herself back up to her feet, gingerly testing her knee to see if it would hold her weight. "You just answered your own question, kid." Bobby arrived at the conference room 5 minutes early, her red and khaki service uniform sharply pressed and marred only by the white wrist brace the company medic had given her for what turned out to be a minor sprain. A Marine in full battle dress and armed with an assault rifle opened the door for her and gave her a smile as she went by. It was a nice smile, full of even, white teeth, below almond-shaped eyes so dark they were almost black. Bobby smiled back and glanced at the name on his suit. Corporal Matsuke. Never knew who you'd run into in the galley or the weight room. It didn't hurt to make a friend or two. She was pulled the rest of the way into the room by someone calling her name. "Sergeant Draper," Captain Thorson repeated, gesturing impatiently toward a chair at the long conference table. "Sir," Bobby said, and snapped off a salute before taking the seat. She was surprised by how few people were in the room. Just Thorson from the Intelligence Corps and two civilians she hadn't met.
"Gunny, we're going over some of the details in your report. We'd appreciate your input."
Bobby waited a moment to be introduced to the two civilians in the room, but when it became clear Thorson wasn't going to do it, she just said,
"Yes, sir, whatever I can do to help."
The first civilian, a severe-looking red-headed woman in a very expensive suit, said, "We're trying to create a better timeline of the events leading up to the attack.
Can you show us on this map where you and your fire team were when you received the radio message to return to the outpost?
Bobby showed them, then went step by step through the events of that day. Looking at the map they'd brought, she saw for the first time how far she'd been flung across the ice by the impact of the orbital mirror. It looked like it had been a matter of centimeters between that and being smashed into dust like the rest of her platoon.
Sergeant, Thorson said, his tone of voice letting her know he'd said it a couple of times before.
Sir, sorry. Looking at these photos sent me wool gathering. It won't happen again.
Thorson nodded, but with a strange expression Bobby couldn't read.
What we're trying to pinpoint is precisely where the anomaly was inserted prior to the attack, the other civilian, a chubby man with thinning brown hair, said. The anomaly, they called it now. You could hear them capitalize the word when they said it. Anomaly, like something that just happens, a strange, random event. It was because everyone was still afraid to call it what it really was. The weapon.
So, the chubby guy said, based on how long you had radio contact and information regarding loss of radio signal from other installations around that area, we are able to pinpoint the source of the jamming signal as the anomaly itself.
Wait, Bobby said, shaking her head.
What?
The monster can't have jammed our radios. It had no tech. It wasn't even wearing a damn spacesuit to breathe. How could it be carrying jamming equipment?
Thorson patted her hand paternally,
a move that irritated Bobby more than it calmed her.
The data doesn't lie, Sergeant. The zone of radio blackout moved, and always at its center was the thing, the anomaly, Thorson said, then turned away from her to speak to the chubby guy and the redhead.
Bobby sat back, feeling the energy move away from her in the room, like she was the one person at the dance without a date. But since Thorson hadn't dismissed her, she couldn't just leave.
Redhead said, based on our radio loss data, that puts insertion here.
She pointed at something on the map, and the path to the UN outpost is along this ridge.
What's in that location? Thorson said with a frown.
Chubby pulled up a different map and pored over it for a few seconds.
Looks like some old service tunnels for the dome's hydro plant. This says they haven't been used in decades.
So, Thorson said,
the kind of tunnels one might use to transport something dangerous that needs to be kept secret.
Yes, Redhead said. Maybe they were delivering it to that marine outpost and it got loose. The marines cut and ran when they saw it was out of control.
Bobby gave a dismissive laugh before she could stop herself.
You have something to add, Sergeant Draper, Thorson said.
Thorson was looking at her with his enigmatic smile, but Bobby had worked with him long enough now to know that what he hated most was bullshit. If you spoke up, he wanted to make sure you actually had something useful to say. The two civilians were looking at her with surprise, as though she were a cockroach that had suddenly stood up on two legs and started speaking. She shook her head.
When I was a boot, you know what my drill sergeant said was the second most dangerous thing in the solar system, after a Martian marine?
The civvies continued to stare at her, but Thorson nodded and mouthed the words along with her as she next spoke.
A UN Marine.
Chubby and Redhead shared a look, and Redhead rolled her eyes for him. But Thorson said,
so, you don't think the UN soldiers were running from something that got out of their control?
Not a fucking chance, sir.
Then give us your take on it.
That UN outpost was staffed by a full platoon of Marines, same strength as our outpost. When they finally started running, there were six left. Six. They fought almost to the last man.
When they ran to us, they weren't trying to disengage. They were coming so we could help them continue the fight.
Chubby picked a leather satchel up off the floor and started rummaging in it. Redhead watched, as though what he was doing was far more interesting than anything Bobby had to say. If this were some secret UN thing that those Marines were tasked to deliver or protect, they wouldn't have come. They'd have died doing it rather than abandon their mission. That's what we would have done.
Thank you, Thorson said. I mean, it wasn't even our fight, and we fought to the last Marine to stop that thing. You think the UN Marines would do less?
Thank you, Sergeant, Thorson said again louder. I tend to agree, but we have to explore all possibilities. Your comments are noted.
Chubby finally found what he was looking for, a small plastic box of mints. He took one out, then held the box out to Redhead to take one. The sickly, sweet smell of spearmint filled the air. Around a mouthful of mint, Chubby said,
Yes, thank you, Sergeant. I think we can proceed here without taking up more of your time.
Bobby stood up, snapped another salute at Thorson, and left the room. Her heart was going fast. Her jaw ached where she was grinding her teeth. Civvies didn't get it. No one did. When Captain Martins came into the cargo bay, Bobby had just finished disassembling the gun housing on her combat suit's right arm. She removed the 3-barrel Gatling gun from its mount and placed it on the floor next to the 24 other parts she'd already stripped off. Next to them sat a can of gun cleaner and a bottle of lubricant, along with the various rods and brushes she'd used to clean the parts. Martins waited until she had the gun on the cleaning mat, then sat down on the floor next to her. She attached a wire brush to the end of one of the cleaning rods, dipped it in the cleaner, and began running the brush through the gun, one barrel at a time. Martins watched. After a few minutes, she replaced the brush with a small cloth and swabbed the remaining cleanser out of the barrels. Then a fresh cloth soaked in gun lubricant to oil them. When she was applying lube to the complex mesh of gears that composed the Gatling mechanism and ammo feed system, Martins finally spoke.
You know, he said, Thorson is naval intelligence right from the start, straight into officer training, top of his class at the academy and first posting at fleet command. He's never done anything but be an intelligence wonk. The last time he fired a gun was his 6 weeks as a boot 20 years ago. He's never led a fire team, or served in a combat platoon.
That, Bobby said, putting down her lubricant, then standing up to put the gun back together, is a fascinating story. I really appreciate you sharing it.
So, Martins continued, not missing a beat, how fucked up do you have to be before Thorson starts asking me if maybe you aren't a little shell-shocked?
Bobby dropped the wrench she was holding, but caught it with her other hand before it could hit the deck.
Is this an official visit? Because if not, you can me now?
I'm not a wonk, Martin said. I'm a Marine. 10 years as an enlisted man before I was offered OCS. Got dual degrees in psychology and theology. The end of Bobby's nose itched, and she scratched it without thinking. The sudden smell of gun oil let her know that she'd just rubbed lubricant all over her face. Martins glanced at it, but didn't stop talking. She tried to drown him out by putting the gun together as noisily as possible. I've done combat drills, CQB training, war games, he said, speaking a little louder. Did you know I was a boot at the same camp where your father was first sergeant? Sergeant Major Draper is a great man. He was like a god to us boots.
Bobby's head snapped up, and her eyes narrowed.
Something about this head shrinker acting like he knew her father felt dirty.
It's true. And if he were here right now, he'd be telling you to listen to me.
Fuck you, Bobby said.
She imagined her father wincing at the use of obscenity to hide her fear.
You don't know shit.
I know that when a gunnery sergeant with your level of training and combat readiness almost gets taken out by a yeoman still at the tail end of puberty, something is goddamned wrong. Bobby threw the wrench at the ground, knocking over the gun oil, which began to spread across her mat like a bloodstain.
I fucking fell down. We were at a full G, and I fell down.
And in the meeting today? Yelling at two civilian intelligence analysts about how Marines would rather die than fail?
I didn't yell, Bobby said, not sure if that was the truth.
Her memories of the meeting had become confused when she was out of the room.
How many times have you fired that gun since you cleaned it yesterday?
What? Bobby said, feeling nauseated and not sure why.
For that matter, how many times had you fired it since you cleaned it the day before that? Or the one before that?
Stop it, Bobby said, waving one hand limply at Martins and looking for a place to sit back down.
Have you fired that gun even once since you've come on board the Daejeon? Because I can tell you that you've cleaned it every single day you've been on board, and several times you've cleaned it twice in one day.
No, I... Bobby said, finally sitting down with a thump on an ammo canister. She had no memory of having cleaned the gun before that day.
I didn't know that.
This is post-traumatic stress disorder, Bobby. It's not a weakness or some kind of moral failure. It's what happens when you live through something terrible. Right now, you're not able to process what happened to you and your men on Ganymede, and you're acting irrationally because of it, Martin said, then moved over to crouch in front of her. She was afraid for a moment that he'd try to take her hand, because if he did, she'd hit him. He didn't.
You're ashamed, he said, but there's nothing to be ashamed of. You're trained to be tough, competent, ready for anything. They taught you that if you just do your job and remember your training, you can deal with any threat. Most of all, they taught you that the most important people in the world are the ones standing next to you on the firing line.
Something twitched in her cheek just under her eye, and Bobby rubbed at the spot hard enough to make stars explode in her vision.
Then you ran into something that your training couldn't prepare you for, and against which you had no defense. And you lost your teammates and friends.
Bobby started to reply, and realized she'd been holding her breath. So instead of speaking, she exhaled explosively.
Martins didn't stop talking. We need you, Roberta. We need you back. I haven't been where you are, but I know a lot of people who have, and I know how to help you, if you let me, if you talk to me. I can't take it away. I can't cure you, but I can make it better.
Don't call me Roberta, Bobby said so quietly that she could barely hear herself. She took a few short breaths, trying to clear her head, trying not to hyperventilate. The sense of the cargo bay washed over her, the smell of rubber and metal from her suit, the acrid, competing scents of gun oil and hydraulic fluid, old and aged right into the metal, no matter how many times the Navy boys swabbed the decks. The thought of thousands of sailors and Marines passing through this same space, working on their equipment and cleaning these same bulkheads, brought her back to herself. She moved over to her reassembled gun and picked it up off the mat before the spreading pool of gun oil could touch it.
No, Captain. Talking to you is not what's going to get me better.
Then what, Sergeant?
That thing that killed my friends and started this war?
Somebody put that thing on Ganymede, she said, and seated the gun in its housing with a sharp metallic click. She gave the triple barrels a spin with her hand, and they turned with the fast, oily hiss of high-quality bearings.
I'm going to find out who, and I'm going to kill them.
Chapter 9. Avasarala. The report was more than 3 pages long, but Soren had managed to find someone with the balls to admit it when he didn't know everything. Strange things were happening on Venus, stranger than Avasarala had known or guessed. A network of filaments had nearly encased the planet in a pattern of 50-kilometer-wide hexagons, and apart from the fact that they seemed to carry superheated water and electrical currents, no one knew what they were. The gravity of the planet had increased by 3%. Paired whirlwinds of benzene and complex hydrocarbons were sweeping the impact craters like synchronized swimmers, where the remains of Eros Station had smashed into the planetary surface. The best scientific minds of the system were staring at the data with their jaws slack. And the reason no one was panicking yet was that no one could agree on what they should panic about. On one hand, the Venusian metamorphosis was the most powerful scientific tool ever. Whatever happened did so in plain sight of everyone. There were no non-disclosure agreements or anti-competition treaties to be concerned with. Anyone with a scanner sensitive enough could look down through the clouds of sulfuric acid and see what was going on today. Analyses were confidential. Follow-up studies were proprietary, but the raw data was orbiting the sun for anyone to see. Only, so far, it was like a bunch of lizards watching the World Cup. Politely put, they weren't sure what they were looking at. But the data was clear. The attack on Ganymede and the spike in the energy expended on Venus had come at exactly the same time, and no one knew why.
"Well, that's worth shit," she said. Avasarala closed down her hand terminal and looked out the window.
Around them, the commissary murmured softly, like the best kind of restaurant, only without the ugly necessity of paying for anything. The tables were real wood, and arranged carefully so that everyone had a view and no one could be overheard unless they wanted to be. It was raining that day. Even if the raindrops hadn't been pelting the windows, blurring city and sky, she'd have known by the smell. Her lunch, cold sagaloo, and something that was supposed to be tandoori chicken, sat on the table untouched. Soren was still sitting across from her, his expression polite and alert as a Labrador retriever's.
"There's no data showing a launch," Soren said. "Whatever's on Venus would have to have gotten out to Ganymede, and there's no sign of that at all."
"Whatever's on Venus thinks inertia's optional, and gravity isn't a constant. We don't know what a launch would look like. As far as we know, they could walk to Jupiter."
The boy's nod conceded the point.
"Where do we stand on Mars?"
"They've agreed to meet here. They've got ships on the way with a diplomatic delegation, including their witness."
"The Marine? Draper?"
"Yes, ma'am. Admiral Nguyen is in charge of the escort."
"He's playing nice? So far?"
"All right. Where do we go from here?"
Avasarala asked.
"Jules Pierre Mao's waiting in your office, ma'am."
"Run him down for me. Anything you think's important?"
Soren blinked. Lightning lit the clouds from within.
"I sent the briefing."
She felt a stab of annoyance that was half embarrassment. She'd forgotten that the background on the man was in her queue. There were 30 other documents there, too, and she'd slept poorly the night before, troubled by dreams in which Arjun had died unexpectedly. She'd had widowhood nightmares since her son had died in a skiing accident, her mind conflating the only two men she'd ever loved. She'd meant to review the information before breakfast. She'd forgotten. But she wasn't going to admit it to some European brat just because he was smart, competent, and did everything she said.
"I know what's in the briefing. I know everything," she said, standing up. "This is a fucking test. I'm asking what you think is important about him."
She walked away, moving toward the carved oak doors with a deliberate speed that made Soren scramble a little to keep up.
"He's the corporate controlling interest of Maukukowski Mercantile," Soren said, his voice low enough to carry to her and then die. "Before the incident, they were one of Protogen's major suppliers. The medical equipment, the radiation rooms, the surveillance and encryption infrastructure. Almost everything Protogen put on Eros, or used to construct their shadow station, came from a Maokwik warehouse and on a Maokwik freighter. And he's still breathing free air because," she said, pushing through the doors and into the hallway beyond. "No evidence that Maokwik knew what the equipment was for," Soren said. "After Protogen was exposed, Maokwik was one of the first to turn over information to the investigation committee. If they, and by they I mean he, hadn't turned over a terabyte of confidential correspondence, Gutman's daughter and Kolb might never have been implicated." A silver-haired man with a broad Andean nose walking the other way in the hall looked up from his hand terminal and nodded to her as they drew near.
"Victor," she said, "I'm sorry about Annette."
"The doctors say she'll be fine," the Andean said. "I'll tell her you asked."
"Tell her I said to get the hell out of bed before her husband starts getting dirty ideas," she said,
and the Andean laughed as they passed. Then to Soren,
"Was he cutting a deal? Cooperation for clemency?"
"That was one interpretation, but most people assumed it was personal vengeance for what happened to his daughter."
"She was on Eros," Avasarala said.
"She was Eros," Soren said as they stepped into the elevator. "She was the initial infection. The scientists think the protomolecule was building itself, using her brain and body as a template." The elevator doors closed, the car already aware of who she was and where she was going. It dropped smoothly as her eyebrows rose.
"So, when they started negotiating with that thing,
they were talking to what was left of Jules Pierre Mao's daughter," Soren said. "I mean, they think they were." Avasarala whistled low.
"Did I pass the test, ma'am?"
Soren asked, keeping his face empty and impassive except for a small twinkle in the corners of his eyes that said he knew she'd been bullshitting him. Despite herself, she grinned.
"No one likes a smart ass," she said.
The elevator stopped. The doors slid open. Jules Pierre Mao sat at her desk, radiating a sense of calm with the faintest hint of amusement. Avasarala's eyes flickered over him, taking in the details. Well-tailored silk suit that straddled the line between beige and gray, receding hairline unmodified by medical therapies, startling blue eyes that he had probably been born with. He wore his age like a statement that fighting the ravages of time and mortality was beneath his notice. 20 years earlier, he'd just have been devastatingly handsome. Now he was that, and dignified too. And her first animal impulse was that she wanted to like him.
"Mr. Mao," she said, nodding to him, "sorry to make you wait."
"I've worked with government before," he said. He had a European accent that would have melted butter.
"I understand the constraints. What can I do for you, Assistant Undersecretary?"
Avasarala lowered herself into her chair. The Buddha smiled beatifically from his place by the wall. The rain sheeted down the window, shadows giving the near subliminal impression that Mao was weeping. She steepled her fingers.
"You want some tea?"
"No, thank you," Mao said.
"Soren, go get me some tea."
"Yes, ma'am," the boy said.
"Soren?"
"Ma'am?"
"Don't hurry."
"Of course not, ma'am." The door closed behind him. Mao's smile looked weary.
"Should I have brought my attorneys?"
"Those rat fuckers? No," she said.
The trials are all done with. I'm not here to reopen any of the legal wrangling. I've got real work to do.
I can respect that, Mao said. I have a problem, Avasarala said, and I don't know what it is.
And you think I do?
It's possible. I've been through a lot of hearings about one damn thing and another. Most of the time, they're exercises in arse covering. If the unvarnished truth ever came out at one, it would be because someone screwed up.
The bright blue eyes narrowed. The smile grew less warm.
You think my executives and I were less than forthcoming? I put powerful men in prison for you, Assistant Undersecretary. I burned bridges.
Distant thunder mumbled and complained. The rain redoubled its angry tapping at the pane. Avasarala crossed her arms.
You did. But that doesn't make you an idiot. There are still things you say under oath and things you dance around. This room isn't monitored. This is off the record. I need to know anything you can tell me about the protomolecule that didn't come out in the hearings.
The silence between them stretched. She watched his face, his body, looking for signs, but the man was unreadable. He'd been doing this too long, and he was too good at it. A professional.
Things get lost, Avasarala said. There was one time during the finance crisis that we found a whole auditing division that no one remembered. Because that's how you do it. You take part of a problem, and you put it somewhere. Get some people working on it, and then you get another part of the problem, and get other people working on that. And pretty soon, you have 7, 8, 100 different little boxes with work going on, and no one talking to anyone because it would break security protocol.
And you think,
we killed Protogen, and you helped. I'm asking whether you know of any little boxes lying around somewhere. And I'm very much hoping you say yes.
Is this from the Secretary General or Ehrenreich?
No, just me.
I've already said everything I know, he said.
I don't believe that.
The mask of his persona slipped. It lasted less than a second. Nothing more than a shift in the angle of his spine and a hardness in his jaw, here and gone again. It was anger. That was interesting.
They killed my daughter, he said softly. Even if I'd had something to hide, I wouldn't have.
How did it come to be your girl? Avasarala asked. Did they target her? Was somebody using her against you?
It was bad luck. She was out in the deep orbits trying to prove something. She was young and rebellious and stupid. We were trying to get her to come home, but she was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Something tickled at the back of Avasarala's mind. A hunch, an impulse. She went with it.
Have you heard from her since it happened?
I don't understand.
Since Eros Station crashed into Venus, have you heard from her?
It was interesting watching him pretend to be angry now. It was almost like the real thing. She couldn't have said what about it was inauthentic. The intelligence in his eyes, maybe. The sense that he was more present than he had been before. Real rage swept people away. This was rage as a gambit.
My Julie is dead, he said, his voice shaking theatrically. She died when that bastard alien thing went down to Venus. She died saving the Earth.
Avasarala countered soft. She lowered her voice, let her face take on a concerned, grandmotherly expression. If he was going to play the injured man, she could play the mother.
Something lived, she said. Something survived that impact. And everybody knows that it did. I have reason to think
that it didn't stay there. If some part of your daughter made it through that change, she might have reached out to you, tried to contact you, or her mother. There is nothing I want more than to have my little girl back, Mao said, but she's gone. Avasarala nodded. All right, she said. Is there anything else? Again, the false anger. She ran her tongue against the back of her teeth, thinking. There was something here. Something beneath the surface. She didn't know what she was looking at with Mao. You know about Ganymede? She said. Fighting broke out, he said. Maybe more than that, she said. The thing that killed your daughter is still out there. It was on Ganymede. I'm going to find out how and why. He rocked back. Was the shock real? I'll help if I can, he said, his voice small. Start with this. Is there anything you didn't say during the hearings? A business partner you chose not to mention, a backup program or auxiliary staff you outfitted. If it wasn't legal, I don't care. I can get you amnesty for just about anything, but I need to hear it now. Right now. Amnesty? He said as if she'd been joking. If you tell me now, yes? If I had it, I would give it to you, he said. I've said everything I know. All right, then. I'm sorry to have taken your time. And I'm sorry to open old wounds. I lost a son. Charanpal was 15. A skiing accident. I'm sorry, Mao said. If you find out something more, bring it to me, she said. I will, he said, rising from his seat. She let him get almost to the doorway before she spoke again. Jules? Turning to glance over his shoulder, he looked like a still frame from a film. If I find out that you knew something, and you didn't tell me, I won't take it well, she said. I'm not someone you want to fuck with. If I didn't know that when I came in, I do now, Mao said. It was as good a parting line as any. The door closed behind him. Avasarala sighed, leaning back in her chair. She shifted to look at the Buddha. Fat lot of help you were, you smug bastard, she said. The statue, being only a statue, didn't reply. She thumbed down the lights and let the gray of the storm fill the room. Something about Mao didn't sit well with her. It might only have been the practiced control of a high-level corporate negotiator, but she had the sense of being cut out of the loop, excluded. That was interesting, too. She wondered if he would try to counter her. Maybe go over her head. It would be worth telling Ehrenreich to expect an angry call. She wondered. It was a stretch to believe there was anything human down on Venus. The protomolecule, as well as anyone understood it, had been designed to hijack primitive life and remake it into something else. But if the complexity of a human mind had been too much for it to totally control, and the girl had in some sense survived the descent, if she'd reached out to her daddy. Avasarala reached for her hand terminal and opened a connection to Soren. Ma'am?